Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Wake Up to Purpose with your host, John Stanko. This program will help you find your purpose and, more importantly, how to make your purpose work for you. And now, here's John Stanko.
Well, hello out there in Internet Radio Land. This is John Stanko, your host, and we are going to have what I hope is a good show, and I only say that is because we have a little confusion on how to connect here, but I'm sure we will get it together. And today I'm going to have as my guest Dr. Pastor Martha Nebambandi, who I've met in the past, but now have become even more connected with through publishing and through her really fascinating journey and story of her call to address world hunger, specifically right now on the continent of Africa, and even more specifically in her native country of Cameroon. And so we're going to talk with her about her journey and about her work, and so as soon as I get her on here, we will be talking. Anyway, let me just resend the number. So I just got off a phone call. There we see. I see the phone light up. So we will be ready to talk to Dr. Martha in just a moment. But I just got off the phone. You know, God is good, and I'm teaching a new class next term for Ottawa University, and I mentioned it yesterday on my Facebook Live. It's the history of Christian thought. Nothing I have taught before. I've done something close, Foundations of Christian Thought, but the book was pre-assigned. It's something that the faculty has already approved at the university, so I can't change it. And so I'm just seeking the Lord, how are we going to do this? Then I make the phone call this morning because I'm co-teaching it. I do the online portion, and somebody else does the in-class portion called a hybrid class, hybrid because it's part live and part online. And so then I find out we're teaching part two of the class, and because part one wasn't taught in the fall because of COVID and scheduling. And so we're teaching part two this coming term, and then we'll teach part one in the fall. So we're actually putting two syllabi together, but doing part two first. And but God is I've always said he's a great administrator, is the best organizer I've ever seen and worked with. And so we had just a great hour and a half session, and I don't know whether I say the seas parted or the clouds opened, but and there it was, the way to structure it, because, you know, these are undergraduate students, 20, 21 years old, to talk about history of Christian thought. I sat through enough classes where the reason I didn't fall asleep on the floor is I had myself propped up well enough in my desk, and I don't want to repeat that. I want the classes that I teach for the students to be engaged and involved, and at the end of the session say, that was pretty good, I learned something. I think we found the key, and so I am looking forward to doing that. Now, having said that, I have to put the syllabi together for both part two and part one. So that will be my Christmas project, along with a revamp of my website. And my website, once I launched my app this year, my website became, I don't want to say obsolete, but it was in the wrong format. And so we're going to go back and streamline and simplify, which is kind of cool because it's been 12 years since I put the first one together, and there's some stuff on there that we need to update or remove and make it a little more nimble, a little less cumbersome, because my website is my repository for everything, a lot of things that I've written. And that's why we redid it 12 or 13 years ago, because the code and everything else was just inadequate for what I was asking it to do. So anyway, so I've got those projects plus some really, really fascinating and interesting writing projects. I've got one on alternative health. I've got one on scientific evidence for the existence of God, an intelligent being behind creation. I am working on one for a man I met 30 years ago while I was doing prison ministry, and he's been out and very productive and has written, this is his second book, so I'm working on this. It's a summary of the classes he teaches on the addict criminal mind, but it's by no means theoretical. It's very practical. And then I'm looking down my list. I have a book of poetry for a mother whose daughter passed away and was quite a prolific poet, and doing a work for somebody in South Africa, and I've got a couple of my own projects going. But one of them that has now come into my life, and I'm really honored, is by our guest that we will have on the show in just a minute, Pastor Dr. Martha Neba Mbandi. And I'm not going to tell you a lot about the what she's written, but we are going to talk about her burden and her passion. She is a native of Cameroon, and as I wrote up in the show summary, she has a PhD in instructional management and leadership from Robert Morris University. She has a Master's of Divinity from Pittsburgh Theological, and she's got a bachelor's and a master's in nursing and public health from the UK. So we want to talk about that. And so without further ado, let me go ahead and bring her on the show. And it's spinning, and there she is. Dr. Martha, welcome to Wake Up to Purpose.
Hi, Dr. Stanko. How are you? Good day.
I'm very well today. Thank you. Thank you for joining us. And now, you are a pastor, is that correct?
Yes, thank you for having me. I'm a pastor here in Pittsburgh, Verona Presbyterian Church.
Verona Presbyterian Church. And
yes.
How has your church been handling all the shutdowns and COVID, and what impact has it had on the church and the ministry?
Yeah, we thank God none of us has had been infected mm-hmm. with the COVID. Relatives of church members, they're all well, so we thank God for that, although our hearts
mm-hmm.
sympathize with so many people who are sick right now
mm-hmm.
and still dying.
So
we shut down for a while, but we're back now because we have a big sanctuary and we can, you know,
mm-hmm.
we can stay at least 6 feet apart and wear masks
mm-hmm.
and, you know, or we maintain all the CDC guidelines. So we're going to church.
Mm-hmm.
The church is not quite the same, you know. We can hug each other. We,
mm-hmm.
know, we've had to adjust a lot of things.
Yeah.
So, but we thank God all is going well so far. But sad about other places and even our state, you know,
mm-hmm.
the numbers keep going up.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you we've talked a little bit. You spend a good bit of time every week preparing your preach message, don't you?
Yeah, I do. I do spend a lot of time preparing, and I keep asking my friends, how much time do you spend?
mm-hmm.
I spend a lot of time preparing my messages. Well, you know, you're doing the work of God, and I think there's no place for mediocrity. That's my
mm-hmm.
philosophy,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
God has given us the opportunity to be educated. We need to use all of that. He gave it to us for
mm-hmm.
a reason. So
yeah.
I take it very seriously. It doesn't matter how many
mm-hmm.
people are in the church, I take it very seriously.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you are from Cameroon, and I'm looking at a map of Cameroon, and you know how Americans are. We're a little geographically deficient, and so Cameroon is a long, thinner country bordered by Nigeria to the west, and Chad and the Central African Republic to the east, and to the south and the southeast. I see Equatorial Guinea and Gabon and the Republic of the Congo. So tell us a little bit about your early life in Cameroon, and then we want to get into how you got to the United States. But let's start, make first things first. Tell us about growing up in Cameroon.
Yeah, I grew up in Cameroon, and it was called Victoria at the time. Very beautiful location at the Atlantic Ocean. It's an Atlantic Ocean township, you know, at the banks of the Atlantic Ocean. So life was really nice when I was growing up. It was a nice place to be. My dad had just come from the village. He had a very different kind of childhood. His childhood was really very poor. He lost all his siblings. His mother had 12 children, and they all died. And
wow.
He was, except him, of course. He survived. And so he kind of felt, if I have my own children here, they probably will die like my brothers and sisters. And there was no motorable road from the village, was called Bafochu, up in the north. He had to walk on foot down to Victoria, and then got married, and we were born there. So at the time, he worked for an English-based company called the Cameroon Development Corporation. And that's why life was so good, because the corporation had a special school for the children of their workers, and it was a beautiful school. Then the hospital was right next door. And we even had a beautiful botanical garden where we went, you know, played around. Actually, one of the royalties in England, I think it was Prince Charles, visited it at one time. It was a very nice place, well kept. And then we had the ocean, you know, to go play and walk around. So it was pretty good. My dad was poor. He wasn't rich, but we had all those amenities around us. So life at that time was nice. And then eventually, that was before we got independence. We got independence and we reunited, because Cameroon was a German colony. And then after World War One, it was divided between French and English England. And so I was on the English-speaking part, and the French was the other side. But the English-speaking part was small. It was just like, you know, one-fifth of the whole country. So we then united. They asked us in a referendum if we wanted to unite. And we said yes, we wanted to, and we reunited and became a bilingual country. So Cameroon is bilingual, just like Canada. You know, it's French and English. And you may know right now that unity didn't work well. After over 50 years, you know, things just got worse and worse for the English-speaking Cameroonians. And so now they're seeking a secession. And it's not easy, because the English-speaking part is the part that has the oil. You know, they have all. And so it's very hard to let the English-speaking part go. And, you know, there are international interests in supporting this part or the other part. So that's the problem, because, you know, when I was growing up, we didn't know much about the world. We didn't even have television. So all we knew, in fact, when I was in primary school, the area where the school was called Bota. And you can just walk maybe 30, 45 minutes and get to the town itself, which is called Victoria. And so in class one day, the teacher asked, "Where is Queen Victoria?" I was so happy. I put my hands right up. I know where Queen Victoria is. She's in Victoria, which is just about 3 miles away. That was my whole world, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we didn't know. But now it is so different. You know, somebody told me they bought a car to go sell in some country in Africa. And when they went there, they were asking a certain price for the car. And the youth said, "You bought this car for so much in America. Why are you selling it for so much here?" They know so much. They knew from the VIN number how much the person bought the car.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so with technology, not much is hidden. These children see how life goes on in other parts of the world. And they're asking, why are we in this place? Why are we suffering? They see how much minerals, how much natural resources are in Africa. Where is it all going to?
Mm-hmm.
Why are we suffering? And so the youth now are not taking it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we better address it. Otherwise, there is no way we're going to have peace, you know.
Yeah.
There's no way we're going to have peace in the world.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say in one of your writings, you talk about dreaming of going off to school and coming back to Cameroon and having some of those things that you started to realize other people had. Talk to us about your journey there to your education and coming back.
Yeah, you see, the school was, as I said, a beautiful place. So we had children whose parents were well off. They would be chauffeur driven to school. And so those children were so, you know, we didn't have internal plumbing in our house. And, you know, it's hot. I remember we had to walk down from our house to the seashore where we played. And coming back is hot. I remember going to one of my classmates. You know, you have to pass an area where we used to call it senior service areas, where they have these beautiful bungalows with kitchen and refrigerator. You know, it was like candy if anybody gave you ice cube, you know. So I remember always going to the back of the kitchen and ask this girl who I knew was coming to my house on our way home. And she would get into their kitchen and give us an ice cube, put it in her hands. Oh, that was so nice. We'll be sucking the ice cube as if you're sucking candy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we then, you know, go to... I love my home because, you know, my dad loved me so much. You know, after all his siblings I was fortunate to be the first child. So he poured all his love on me. So I was very happy. His name was John, by the way. So I loved him very much, and he loved, and he loved me a lot. So, you know, that was the best place for me to be. And I overheard him. I was always with my dad from when I was 5 years old. You know, he'll be sitting there talking with his friends. He had a gramophone. I don't know if you know what a gramophone is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He had a gramophone, and very few people had gramophone in those days. So our house was always full of people, you know, listening to the gramophone. So I was always sitting there in my father's between his legs and listening, and I just wanted to be with him. And I always heard him say, "This is my daughter. I don't care what gender she is. I'm going to send her to England. I'm going to send her to learn sewing." He was not educated, so learning, that was the best, highest place a girl could go, you know. So I knew from then, I mean, I didn't say anything. I just knew Daddy was sending me to England. And that translated to love. You know, it translated to love. It translated to a lot of confidence. Because if your daddy is just like you and I today saying, "I'm sending my child to the moon," you know, which means your daddy wants the best for you. And which means, you know, you are worth the best that the world can provide. And that is where I get the belief and motivation in this world is worth the best we can give the child. God didn't send these children to this world for them not to eat, for them to be dying at the rate of, 15,000 children dying every day from poverty. You don't even include from hunger alone in this world. 15,000. You know, I have to always remind myself that it is 15,000 a day, not a month or year. 15,000 children a day die from hunger alone. If you include all other preventable the causes of death, it's much more than that, like measles, malaria, diarrhea, all of this. It goes way higher than that, dying a day, you know. So I just can't understand it, you know. I mean, being raised like that and being, you know, it's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
So
you did get to England. He did fulfill his dream and send you off.
Yeah,
is that correct?
Yeah, sure. I went to England. And I went to University of London, where I did my first degree in nursing. and went back to Cameroon. You know, when I went back to Cameroon, I had just done that degree in nursing. I was working in the hospital, and it was not easy. You know, you see people coming and dying for no reason. You know, just because the hospital was not well equipped. And it was during this time when I went back with the degree of nursing. I mean, I can't even say it without tears in my eyes. A child died in my hands. You know, because this child should not have died. You know, in the hospitals with the degree of poverty or whatever is going on, when you go to the hospital, the doctor gives you a prescription just like you go to see your doctor here. But here, at least, you take your prescription, you go to the pharmacy, at least you have insurance. You might pay something, but not that much. But there, you don't have anything. You take that piece of paper. If you don't have money, they don't have money to eat. Why do they have money to buy medication? So this mom had to wait. The child had a cold. That's all the child had. And then had fever, maybe some small bronchitis. She didn't have money. She waited until she could find money. She came. Then when the child already had pneumonia. And I was in the children's unit at the time. This mother brought the child. I saw the child was really, really sick. Brought the child plus the medication that she had gone and purchased. So we administered it quickly. I saw this child was getting shortage of breath, was shortage of oxygen. You know, in the hospital, each time I go to a hospital here, I see oxygen just flowing. I'm like, oh, my goodness. No oxygen. You have one cylinder of oxygen, one cylinder containing oxygen. It is in the theater. So this child was getting cyanosed. You could see he needed oxygen so badly. I picked up the child and ran into the outpatient department of the theater and started administering oxygen. The child started recovering. And I was so happy. I thought, oh, how do I take this oxygen cylinder to the children's unit, you know, and continue this oxygen therapy? Just at that time, I heard the administrator of the hospital say, Mrs. Mbandi, stop. I looked at her, I'm like, why? That's the only bottle of oxygen we have. If you empty it and we have a theater emergency, we're in trouble. You have to stop. I picked up the child, and I had to walk some distance to the children's unit. That child, his color changed. He started gasping, and before I could put this child in his cot, the child died in my hands. You know, I mean, people can read, you can read, I mean, statistics or whatever. When a child dies in your hands, you know this child should not have died. It is everlasting in your mind. It doesn't go away.
Yeah.
And so that was my experience there. And so many of you see so many, I'm a midwife too. I worked in the hospital, in the midwifery section of the hospital. You see a lot of things like that going on. So eventually I left and I went into public health because, you know, like somebody says, it's like mopping the floor with the water running, the tap running. So I went into public health and then I went back to England and did a master's degree in public health from University of Liverpool. And that's what I was doing from different levels, at local council level, then I worked at the state level, and then eventually my children, in fact, we were so very well settled. I love my job. My husband had a good job. He loved it. But we had to send all our children here for university education because we both had international education, and we thought that would be a good idea. The world is getting smaller and smaller. It's always good to have an education where you can work literally anywhere. So we sent them here. I came here in 1994, really came for a visit, but when I came, you know, all the children were just struggling so much to settle down. So we thought we'll stay for a little bit and see them all through at least a bachelor's degree. Then we can leave and go back because, you know, we had our home. We were very well settled there. But then when they all graduated with their bachelor's degree, 2000, I was getting just preparing to go back. And then 2002, I got called to ministry rather suddenly. You know, it was so sudden. I got called to ministry, and then that started another string of education, going back to school. You know, I mean, my children saw me preparing to go back. Till today, you know, they're boys, so I got four boys. you know, to today. I don't know what they thought. I really would love to know what they thought when they saw me going to school. The only one person who said something was my sister. My sister knew I was getting ready to go. She's a nurse down in Georgia. She knew I was preparing to go home, and then suddenly she heard I was going to school, and she called me, and she said, Sister, why are you going to school? She knew I already had a master's degree, and I said, why are you going to school? And I said, I don't know. I'm going to school, and I don't know why I'm going. You know, a call is something, you know. When I was a little kid, I used to hear, oh, it's a call. I'm like, what's a call? Who called you? And I would just laugh and shrug my shoulders. Oh, whatever. I never really went into it to find out what this call is. I just said, it's meant for some kind of people. It's not for me. So my sister asked me, why are you going to school? I said, I don't know. She got so worried. And she said to me, it was about a few years later, she confessed to me that she actually thought she should come and take me to the hospital because something must have gotten seriously wrong with you. Why are you going to school and you say you don't know?
Right.
Yeah. So anyway, so that's how that happened. And so all my plans changed and I'm still here.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're pastoring the Presbyterian Church, but you never got away from the situation in Cameroon or that child dying in your arms. Your heart was still back there, and part of your call over the years was you coming to grips with what God wanted you to do back home. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, as I said, in fact, when I, you know, from the experience I had back home, I always had a passion to do something to help. But I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I kept thinking about so many women dying after childbirth, and I thought, oh, what can I do? Can I, you know, I wasn't thinking of doing anything full-time. It's just like anybody else here. You think, oh, maybe I can buy something and send to this hospital.
Right.
I never thought about a full-time missionary work, you know. So when I got called to ministry, it just happened very, very strangely. And it was about an open house, and I just got this voice that said, Martha, you got to go. It was an open house in Monroeville Bible School. Greater Works Bible School. So, yeah, so on that Thursday, I went there. And, you know, I mean, somebody has to really have experienced this to even imagine, you know, what was going on in my life at the time. So as the call came suddenly, very miraculously, I didn't know what was going on. I just knew I had to go to this Bible school, the open house. So I went to the open house and stupidly thinking somebody there is going to tell me why I'm there. You know? And I remember this teachers coming up, oh, I teach this subject, I teach this subject. I'm like, please, can somebody tell me why I'm here? So eventually they said, if you want to register, go register, blah, blah. I just went, I picked the form, I registered, I paid, signed a check, it wasn't too much, I paid, and started carrying my bags and going to school. I had already started planning to go to Cameroon, leave and return to Cameroon. You know, not that I didn't like America, but I was more settled in Cameroon. I had my home, I had a mortgage and all that kind of stuff. You know, so I went there, started going to school. I used to cry a lot. You know, I used to cry. The good thing they did in that school, they gave you a mentor. You know, Paula Kubrick, I don't know, you might know her. I'm sorry, I'm calling her name. She was my mentor. And, you know, I would go to her office. I could sit there and cry and cry and cry. I didn't know, because something was happening in my life. I didn't know, how can I be going to school when I didn't even plan to go? You know. So a lot of things happened. It's too long of a story. So I started having this urge. I was seeing myself. There was an image, like an image was planted on my soul, on my spirit. I was seeing a group of children in jungle area. They were down in the valley, And one was standing on the hill, and he kept waving to me, "When are you coming? When are you coming?" That image was on my mind all the time. You know, "When are you coming? When are you coming?" So eventually, I kept asking. I would ask a lot of questions to people in the school. What is this thing that has happened to me? And then they would say, "It's a call." And I said, "Okay, so it's a call. So what should I do?"
Mm-hmm.
And they said,
"How
you
do
have
I
to
answer
walk.
It, right?"
They said, "You have to walk by faith." And that was so annoying. You know, you're telling somebody to walk by faith. What does that mean? I mean, I know what it means now, but at the time,
right.
just like a child trying to walk, he said, "No, just stand and walk," you know. You know, so at the time, I couldn't understand what they're talking about. You know, each time I say walk by faith. You know, and something happened. It's so amazing how God works. You know, I was in a class. It was like a counseling class. And this teacher, professor, tutor came in. Her name was Nancy. And she started talking, giving us a lecture. It had nothing to do with that class. She said, walking by faith is like playing the game, a tennis game. When God shoots it to you, you do your part and you shoot it back to him.
Wow.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what she said. And that was what the whole class was about. So I went back to her after class. I'm like, "You know what? You just answered a question that was been really bothering me all this time. Thank you so much." And she said to me, "I don't even know why I thought that lesson today. I got up this morning at 5 a.m. and the Lord put it upon my heart that this is what I've got to teach." And I'm like, "Yeah, the Lord wanted you to teach me." So that's how I started getting, you know, an idea of what walking by faith is. So I was there in that Bible school. I don't know. One thing happened to me when I got called when I was going to school. I felt like I was walking in a box of cloud that surrounded me all the time.
Mm.
That cloud was always there, front, top, sides, and my back. It was not touching me, but that I was aware of the presence, and I was uncomfortable with it. And I started praying. I said, "Lord, whatever this is, please take it away from me," and eventually disappeared. So eventually I started having the urge to go to seminary. And you know what scared me the most? It was that cloud. I felt like if I didn't go, the cloud would come back. I kind of rushed to seminary. I went there, got admitted. So that's why I started going to seminary. But at the time, from this image that I was having of these children calling me, as waving at me, or this boy waving at me, I started having the idea that this may be the group of people that God is calling me to serve. And, you know, that went through, and more I got confidence in that is what God is calling me to do, go serve. And these were children, say about, you know, between 12, 15, 18 years old, who I was doing like that. So this current ministry started. I walked through that in the seminary, and eventually it came clearer and clearer to me that I need to go help these children who are stranded in deep poverty in the village, in the very rural areas of Cameroon or anywhere. So then the call became greater, bigger and bigger. It's not just Cameroon. It's, you know, there are other children in other parts of the world who are in the same situation. You know, but the reason I decided Cameroon is that in my public health training, they said, if you're starting something new, it's better to start it where you know best, the area where you're most familiar with. So that's why I decided Cameroon, you know. Then I thought, I have been in nursing, I've been in public health. I don't know anything about education, you know. And I started trying to negotiate, "Lord, why would you ask me to go do something in education? I don't know anything about education." So that's how I ended up doing that PhD in Robert Morris. And yes, so throughout my research there, my question was, how is it that we can help these children so that they can get out of poverty sustainably? Is there something I can start in Cameroon that we can disseminate it to other similar countries that have similar problems, you know, and solve this problem of poverty, you know, for good, sustainably?
Yeah.
And so that's how this new project started.
Yeah. Well, tell us about the project. I want to make sure we've got about, 23, 24 minutes. I want to make sure we give enough time. Talk to us, of what eventually emerged. And I know you took a trip to Cameroon, but circumstances didn't allow you to start there. You started something in Nigeria. So go ahead and tell us a little bit about that journey.
Yeah, it started actually when I was doing my PhD research. I remember when I went there to, I wasn't like a teenager. I knew why I was doing the PhD. I knew exactly what I wanted to get out of it. So I used to say to the professors, I hope that when I graduate, the day I graduate from this PhD, because, Robert Morris is towards the airport, I'll take off my gown and catch the plane and go to Africa, And they thought I was joking. I'm like, yeah, that's really what I want to do. And this is the research I want. When you're doing PhD, the professors always have at least that field in the back of their mind, what kind of PhD that is necessary. But I said, no, this is what I want to do. And I was fortunate that they allowed me to do it, first of all, to find out how many children of that age group are out of school globally, not just in Cameroon. And what is it that we can do to get them back in school? I know there's a lot has been done, which I'm very grateful. People have been working tirelessly to get children in elementary school and get them through secondary school. But it is good. It's been the results have been progressively getting better. But it is too slow. The world is moving at a fast speed right now. It's so slow that it looks as if the part of the world is moving at a speed of a lightning, and the other part is like a snail speed. And so it looks as if they're instead going downwards, And so what is it that we can do different that will allow these children to go to school? So the first thing is that these children, they are not like the former generation who are looking up to people to come and do things for them. They want to do things themselves. They just want the opportunity. They want to be able to go to school. They've seen how those who have had the opportunity, they see people like me who had the opportunity to go to school, and they see that my life got better.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have trust in education. So they are determined to go to school, just like Oprah said one time when she went and started a school in South Africa. She said, when I went there and I asked every child, what do you want? They said, I want books. I want uniform. I want to go to school. That's how she ended up. And that is the experience I had when I went to Cameroon. They all want to go to school, and they will do what they need to do to have an education. So they want to go to school. How can we make sure that they can all go to school? I see a lot of here, sometimes here, people say, oh, those people over there, they don't want to go. That's not true. Maybe there are a couple of families, for some religious or tribal reason, they may want the girls to get married, but that is very, very few. Majority of people over there want to go to school, majority of parents want their children to go to school. They have experienced what poverty is, the pain of poverty. They don't want their children to go through that again. So they would love for their children to go to school. And so the thing is, it's not that there are no schools. It's poverty, parental poverty. They don't have money to buy books. They don't even have money to feed their children, let alone buy books and pay fees. So how are we going to educate these children, be able to give them, tuition-free secondary school education so that every child can go to school, no matter where the child is. It's accessible to every child. So that was my research. And that is how I came with this program called Teach for Hope, which is what I'm working on now. So it's one thing developing a model, it's on paper, but you can only be sure when you try it. So
isn't that the truth?
So this is still on paper. So I went to Cameroon to do a feasibility study. This was in 2015, and I did the feasibility study. A chief in a village called Guzang gave us a piece of land to, start the school. And in fact, he showed us some two abandoned buildings that we can renovate it and start it there temporarily, then build the school on the land he's given us. So everything was set to go. And we're very fortunate here that the presbytery gave us some money, and Westminster, another church gave us quite a bit of money, and a lot of churches around contributed. So we had enough money to start the school, and we're going to start in 2017. Then 2016, Cameroon, which was like the most peaceful country in the world. As I said, the children are not taking it. The war in Cameroon started by youth, and it's being sustained by youth. We're not taking it anymore, you know. Mm. And so, you know, that's what, I mean, the older people, and, you know, they just said, if you are older than 40 years, we don't want you, stay away.
Mm.
I mean, they've been trying to pull this youth back. They are dying. The government is killing them. You know, there are times the government will go and kill, like, 15 of them in one time. Any number they see, they kill them. But the children said that we're going to die. That's what's going on now.
Yeah.
So because of that, we couldn't go to Cameroon. So we had some money. Over 100,000 Cameroonians fled to Nigeria. So we had the money which we were going to use for the school, and we met an organization which was already working with the children called Mao Global Solutions. And they, when the Nigerian government saw this refugee just rushing into, you know, as you said, Nigeria is bound, we have a common boundary with Nigeria, so that's where they fled to. So this organization had been working with these children, and the government, Nigerian government, had a building which they had abandoned for over 30 years, very big, mighty complex. It was supposed to be a building for legal department. And so the refugees went there. The local government said they could use it. So Mao Global Solutions wanted to use it for a secondary school, but the building had been abandoned for so long that it required a major renovation project. And so that's how we got into it. We renovated the building. We equipped the building, so about 350 children are going there, having secondary school. Secondary school is like middle school to high school there. And then we paid the teachers for 1 year, and so that the school can be stabilized. So Mao Global is running the school right now. The reason we didn't continue, first of all, is I'm still passionate to try this Teach for Hope program so that we can disseminated to other countries so that other children globally should be able to go to school. And that is not just a school. I see that as a solution, a strategy to reduce the death rate from poverty. Because, you know, John, I don't know if you know this, no country in the world has ever gotten out of poverty sustainably to riches sustainably without achieving 80% enrollment rate in secondary school. No country. And Africa is not going to be different. I was just looking at some statistics this morning. You know, globally, from Africa, sub-Sahara Africa, you have for lower secondary school, which is like middle school, only 42% of middle school age children are going to school in sub-Sahara Africa, which means there is 58% of children who are middle school age not going to school. 58% not going to school. So when are we going to get that 80% to get out of poverty? I know the elementary school, I know you have a school there, which is great. Many elementary school, without elementary school, you cannot get to middle school, which is wonderful. That everybody wants. But elementary school now doesn't get anybody out of poverty. If you saw those children that I saw in Cameroon, I sent you some of their stories. All of them went to elementary school, but they are all stuck there, trapped in extreme poverty. They can't go anywhere. So that is my passion. Yeah, that's my passion, to field test this Teach of Hope, and then I am very, very convinced that it's going to work. I'm not doing it by myself. You know, they are very well educated and experienced people. You've been to Africa. They're all many educated and experienced people there. So what I plan to do is to take this module, get there, get a committee, we sit down and see how this module is going to work. Because what would work in one location or one nation is not the same like the other one. So there is no, you know, one size fits all. For example, one of the ways we think that we're going to, I don't know if I should even go to that or maybe wait for you to ask me.
No, go ahead.
Question. Okay.
Go ahead.
So, yeah, so I believe that if we're going to be waiting to get external help for these children to go to school, it's just going to take as long as it has been taking or even longer because the population is growing. You know, so this Teach for Hope module has two components. It has an education component and it has a funding component. The education component is just, I mean, it's like maybe any high school, but the difference in the education component is that every child who graduates from the high school will have a minor as a trade. You have a technical minor. The technical minor could be agriculture, doing hair, sewing, I don't know, any kind of painting, renovation. So you graduate with carpentry. You graduate with a high school certificate plus a technical minor. Because a lot of people say, and it's true, you go to Africa, you see some children who have high school and they're hanging on the streets. They don't have a job. Some even graduate, they don't have a job. Because the curriculum that was used was the curriculum they inherited from the colonial masters. The idea of educating children those days was not to develop the country. It was to get a group of people who work in their factories and manufacture whatever so that they can export it or whatever, you know. So there was nothing like a combined academic plus technical. And right now, some schools in Africa, they're doing that, even all over the world. They have what they call technical vocational, T-V-E-T, technical vocational education training, which is combined with academic training. And that is what that first cycle of education would be in the Teach for Hope. And, you know, I thought to myself, if we can establish a system, a funding system that is effective, why end at the secondary school level? Why not continue to the community college level? So all children can have from secondary to community college. It's like we leapfrog. That is what, you know, we're trying to do here, to have free community college at least or first degree. We're trying to do that here. But if we have the opportunity to establish a funding system which is self-revolving, why then end at the secondary school? We can leapfrog to secondary community college for all. And that's why this program is a secondary to first degree or community college education, which would be wonderful if we can do that, you know. So that is the academic component and the technical component of the school. That's one component of it. And the second one is how do we finance this? You know, yes, we will need some external help because I need to build a school and the children will not be there. I have to build a school before the children start and we have to support the school for a while, maybe 3-4 years, for this funding system to establish. And so I have three of them. Now, the main reason here is, number one, how are you going to teach them a vocation? It has to be hands-on. You know, vocations are not taught in class.
Right.
Maybe they are, but it's not effective. It has to be hands-on. So we have to find different trades where the children can have hands-on technical vocational education. And I think the best way to do it, if we are training these children to be able to graduate and go to their homes and start some trade or start some business, just giving them the technical skill is not enough. You have to teach them how to make money from their skills. So the best way to do it is for them, I have one program which is the school-run enterprises. You know, it has to be challenging for them. You know, tell them, go, you know, what business would you like to start? You just let them use their brain and start some program. They live there. They know their country better than me coming there. So what business would you like to... What business would you like to start? And let them go and start a business. Maybe they want to go start a little farm, a little poultry. And then we start it. If they want a little property, they start a poultry. And so we start those little businesses. And I would like for them to start small. They start small and then grow so that they don't think that they need, you know, the hundreds of dollars or millions of francs or dollars to start a business. They know that they can start a business small and then grow it. You know, so we start those small businesses. They start it. They have somebody who is going to help them start the business or supervise, and let them fail. They can fail, they can succeed, and just learn how to start and run a business. So that is what. So out of those small school-run minor micro enterprises, obviously they will have one or two that will be very promising. Maybe you start a bakery, for instance, and you see that the people in the city is a business that can be successful. Then we can blow that out and start a big enterprise. The purpose of the big enterprise now is just purely to get money to run the school. We can employ people from outside, and then the children can come there just for experience. So that's one, two of them, actually. And then the other one is learn and earn. And this is something which I think is like, for instance, I believe here you get some restaurants that employ high school students over the weekend, right? They come there to earn some little pocket money. That's the whole concept. You know, the businesses have to pay salaries anyway. So I'm saying that if you're an entrepreneur who wants to help, you start your business and give these children the opportunity to come and work there, maybe 1 or 2 hours a day, you know, and then we agree on some how much you pay, because you have to pay workers. So why don't you give these children opportunity to work in your factory? So but the factory has to be close to the school, or we give you a piece of land to build some little thing there, you know. And so you agree on an hourly rate, and these children will come there 1 or 2 hours a day, or maybe half a day, 2 half days per week. And you at the end of the month, we calculate how many student hours were put in your business. And you cut the check, and you send it to the school. We use that to buy their books, feed them, pay teachers. So all of these three income-generating businesses, it's what I hope will use it to pay the teachers, feed the children, do what they need to do to have this education. But remember, you know, Africa, it is, fortunately, it's not very expensive. You know, the salaries are reasonable, feeding is reasonable. So hopefully for me, and all of this is going to be managed by a financial management committee, which is consisting of representatives of all stakeholders, including government. So it's not something that I'm going to manage. People will see exactly where each penny is going to. And all the money is staying in that nation. You know, we'll use it to develop the school. And then I'm hoping that we'll use the church growth model. You know how one church, you pay it forward to another location. Mm-hmm. You know, you say... Right. From the beginning, you save 10% of whatever you're making, and when you get to a certain amount, you try to, you know, start another school, another place. But not all the schools we have, the community college. So some of the smaller schools, they can use the main community college for the community college degree or diploma. Well, I don't know. I hope I've made it clear somehow.
Yeah, well, you certainly have, and it's, you know, we've only got 3 or 4 minutes left, but, you know, Americans of the West tend to think in terms of millions of dollars and big production, but it doesn't have to be like that in Africa, does it? It can be simple, but it can be connected to the people, and it can be very effective. Isn't that right?
It is right. I mean, I actually, you know, simple doesn't mean inferior.
Right.
You know, it doesn't mean inferior at all. Simple means it is simple, well run, and it contains all the components that the children need to get the kind of diploma that they can work anywhere. Because the companies that are running in Africa, they're not just going to employ anybody just because you're an African. They have to prove that they have the correct, the appropriate training for their whatever the employee is supposed to do. So we have to compete with that. We don't want to, you know, children to graduate and be standing on the street because they didn't come from a well reputable school.
And you know, our school in Kenya has we helped them start a brick making company. And they don't have a building. They don't have a, you know, a location. They have it set up in a rural area, and they make bricks, and they're going to feed the orphanage, or they're going to clothe the orphanage this Christmas with new clothes with the proceeds from the brick-making business. It's very, by our standards, I'll call it primitive, but I don't want it, to, like you said, to sound inferior. It's not. They're making good bricks. They're they're selling them, I think, about in our cost for a nickel each. They're making 2 or 3 cents a brick, and they're making money, and it's working.
Exactly, it works. It works. Mm-hmm. And so, just imagine that is what if we find something and that is working, and the population needs it, then we blow it out.
Right.
So you can be the main brick maker for the whole country or the whole region. It brings in a lot of money. A lot of money that you can use to run the school.
Or we will use
to run the school.
Yeah, and we have another orphanage. We helped them plant, my partners helped them plant tea. So they have a few acres of tea, and when it's mature, it will be sufficient to feed the orphanage for every month.
Exactly.
And so, and they have the young people out learning how to plant the tea, care for the tea, harvest the tea, and... And that's exactly what you're talking about. And I think you know, and I like it because, you know, you are obviously from Africa, but you understand the West. And I think you are the right person with the call, obviously, that God has chosen to do this. Now, Martha, how can people get in touch with you? Does John Neba International Ministries, do you have a website or a Facebook page? Or how can people get in touch with you if they're interested in learning more and also helping you do this?
Oh, thank you. We have a website, but just like you say, you are going to update. Your website needs to be updated. For now, if anybody wants to get in touch with me, I'm still working on my Facebook page. You can just my name at gmail.com. You can send me email directly. We have a ministry, and we have a board. We have Karen is our treasurer. So if you get in touch with me, I can put in whatever, however you want to do. You want to be part. Because what I really want to do now, John, is to for people to join this, for people to be part of this. Because you can't do something. We need a lot of hands. We need brain to look at this and tweak it and see how it's going to work. You know, if you have some ideas or what you can, how you can make this work, or you want to just be part of it to, you know, put in your own expertise for it to work. We need a lot of things like that. So you can get in touch with me at Martha Neba. Martha Neba, N-E-B-A. Martha Neba at gmail.com. And depending on how you want to participate, I can either connect you to a treasurer or whatever you like to do. That would be
very good.
And above all, please pray for us.
Yes,
pray for our children, because we live in this world, as I said in one of my posts. I mean, we're expecting to have a peaceful world. We can't have a peaceful world when there are people hungry. Thousands of people dying every day, 20,000, 25,000 dying. So even the ones who are not dead, they're managing. They're angry. A hungry man is an angry man. How are you going to have peace when people are angry? You know?
Yeah.
I went to Cameroon 2015. I saw two boys, five of them. If you see their images, they all look so sad. They can't even eat a meal a day. So you just need one of these Boko Haram, of these extreme groups to go there. And it's easy to convince children like that. Where do these Boko Haram and extreme groups? That is where they get their recruitment base. These children in the extreme villages, so poor, they're just hungry, and all they need to say, come, I'll give you a meal a day. Plus a little pocket money, they got their recruits. That's why they are surviving. these extreme groups are surviving because they have these children hanging around in these poor villages, you know. So we are spending money, you know, trying to stop all kinds of wars all over the place, or we spend the money to prevent that.
Is that Martha, you're the Roman for the job. Thank you for your time. God bless you, and you know we'll stay in touch.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Stanford.
All right.
Thanks
God
for
bless.
Having me.
Bye-bye.
I really appreciate it. God bless. Bye-bye.
All righty. God bless. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
All right. Martha Nebba found her purpose. You go find yours. So long for now.
Thanks again for listening to Wake Up to Purpose with John Stanko. To get in touch with John, you can go to www.purposequest.com or write him at johnstanko@gmail.com.